Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It is a kind of drizzly, cold Sunday here in Brooklyn, and I'm warmed in the station right now by two veteran movers and shakers of the Brooklyn food world, and the greater food world, I would say. They have teamed up to create a project which, you know, by the best of both their generous brains is no doubt awesome. It is called the Good Fork Cookbook, which I'm holding right now. It is written by the chef, co-owner of the Good Fork restaurant in Red Hook, Brooklyn, Sohi Kim. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And it's also co-written by Rachel Wharton, veteran James Beard Award-winning food writer.
Yay. Hello. How are you, Kathy?
I'm good. Former host here at Heritage.
Yes.
Former... a little bit of everything. Editor at magazines, Edible Brooklyn, Manhattan. Okay, so you guys teamed up to write this cookbook. It's cool that it came out on the 10th anniversary of opening the Good Fork.
Probably wasn't even planned. Well, originally.
Originally, no, but it sort of happened that way, and I think it was perfect.
Yeah. So the Good Fork opened in 2006, and at that time, Red Hook wasn't like a very happening place in Brooklyn, at least.
No.
Brooklyn itself wasn't known as a restaurant capital.
Right.
Yeah. So
the movement was just happening, which, you know, I didn't think was happening, but it was happening.
And that's just where you lived?
It was a place that my husband Ben and I, you know, we purchased a dilapidated house and we fixed it up. And I was around that time kind of tired of working in Manhattan and was looking to do something on my own eventually. Mm-hmm. But and I didn't think that I was ready in 2006. But, you know, we got the place and things kind of happened very quickly.
Yeah.
And,
I love reading about that history.
Yeah, it was a big leap of faith. Not at all ready, but but kind of ready.
Flying and, sort of blind. And
yeah.
And your husband, Ben, is a carpenter, so he built the restaurant.
He did. He, you know, I always say it's the craziest budget that we had, which was... no money.
Nothing.
Budget.
Really?
So it really was a project, you know, born out of like excitement, enthusiasm, a lot of naivete of how the restaurant business worked. And it was really like, you build it and I cook and then hopefully we'll have some customers.
Right. But you sort of honed your kitchen skills in some of the finest kitchens in New York, working with Anita Lowe at Anissa.
Yeah.
And you also worked at Blue Hill for a while.
I did. And I, you know, I definitely had a lot of great cooking jobs working under some amazing chefs. So, you know, I wasn't ready, but certainly...
But did you know what it took to open a restaurant?
Not at all. That's the thing. I was kind of cocky as a cook, right?
Okay.
Been cooking, you know, for several years under these amazing people. And you're like, yeah, I got this. You know, I could do this.
But hey, it wasn't in Manhattan. It was sort of under the radar kind of place.
And I think that's the whole thing about that era is that people wanted to get away from sort of the fine dining, away from Manhattan. And that's how the Brooklyn hip, cool, the food scene sort of happened.
And it was a community thing. Like the first week or so is just your friends and neighbors.
Right.
And then it blew up from there.
Yeah. It was where you lived. You wanted to do it where you lived.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. you're also a pioneer in terms of the food. And for anyone who hasn't been to the Good Fork and knows sort of, it's hard to describe. So I wanted to read a little bit from your description in the introduction. You write, I knew well before we opened the Good Fork that I wanted to cook globally inspired cuisine. Not exotic or eclectic, just flavorful. It's how I cooked at home. I would add a dab of Chinese fermented black beans to my gravy when I roasted a chicken. Good trick. Or kimchi to my steak and eggs. Ultimately, I merged everything I learned about French and Italian technique from my day job as a cook with the American classics I'd come to love from the Korean cooking that's in my bones. So you put Asian dumplings on your menu.
Yeah.
And you also had a very traditional sort of Italian ragu,
right,
like wild boar Tuscan ragu on the menu at the same time at the Good Fork.
Yeah.
And people were like, or at least you said your family members were like, what the heck is that?
Yeah, I say it in the book. My brother was like, what are you, crazy? You can't do that.
You know, dumplings.
What did he think you should do? Did he offer you a substitution?
No, he said you either do, it's either, you know, Korean food or Asian food, or you focus on Italian food, or if you want like a... So he was very much, you know, he was towing the line of tradition. And back then, it was very much like that. You open up, you know, zagats, and it's like you have the Italian and you have French, and it was very sort of regimented, and the blurring the lines back then wasn't happening. But I think myself, the Good Fork, and there were other restaurants that were willing to do that and taking the chance to do that. And I think that's when the palates of New Yorkers sort of started changing too. Why just be so beholden to this one concept? Why not be a little bit playful?
Right, because people wanted other flavors too that they didn't know or that they had just tasted.
Right, and the word fusion to me didn't quite do the trick. And I think because of the time, it was sort of like that confusion.
We remember
fusion.
The 90s.
It's still a bad word. It really still is.
Yeah, we don't.
Even though everything, I mean, it's like almost everything is fusion.
Cuisines are being fused.
Yeah.
But we don't call it fusion. Right. What would you call it, though, globally?
It usually takes like at least three sentences to say fusion.
it does. You're right. Okay. Can we just use fusion or
not? I know. Lately. I want to bring back the word because it just completely, people hate it so much. I did a story for the Journal about this word, actually. Actually, based on working on our cookbook, just because I could see that people get so uncomfortable, even though it's truly what you're doing. There's nothing to be ashamed of.
Does it depend on who uses the word? Because Sohi was saying, you know, she does things in a very natural way. You know, this cooking is in my bones, and then this cooking is what I learned.
Right.
And I don't know. And then I feel like with the old sort of fusion, that was a sort of label slapped onto restaurants that were very, how do I say, deliberately, you know, consciously trying to be a little funky and crazy.
Well, actually,
failing
was the Asian. I did this whole story. I traced this whole thing.
Okay.
So I think, it was several years ago, but I think when it really started to falter was with like the explosion of cheap Asian fusion places.
That's it.
But like, I think the original term was in the 80s with Norman Van Aken, who was cooking in Florida, and he was completely inspired by the Bahamian and Caribbean ingredients that were used in that area, and he wanted to bring what he like this renaissance of American food and ingredients, and he wanted to use what he knew, what was in his place, and so it actually started in like completely the same place of integrity.
What people left with that word fusion was the bad.
By the late 80s, 90s, it was like Thai, Chinese, something wraps.
There's always involved Asian. You never hear this is a Israeli fusion. Or you know.
Even though like completely we have that.
Totally. Or Italian fusion. Yeah.
There's like an Israeli-Brazilian place, that just opened in the Upper West Side.
So I don't really object to the word as much as I did about 10, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. Sort of like what you said, Rachel, like taking it back, you know what I mean? Because
let's
it is. Essentially, it was and is fusion done right. And I think that's you have to sort of clarify, is it done right? Or are people and how do you know if it's being done right? When people
it
enjoy
tastes
it.
Good.
And it tastes good. And you could taste the various ingredients on its own terms, and it's not muddled, and it doesn't lose its integrity. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really honestly tried to do, and I thought a lot about it with the first menu.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it a fusion, so if I have an Italian dish on there, and that is wholeheartedly made,
it's
you know, Italian homemade pasta and really follow the traditions of how a ragu and the flavor develops, then it'll stand on its own. And then we could put an Asian dumpling next to it. So the biggest question for Ben and I, will people order, you know, Asian dumplings, pork and chive dumplings to start their meal and then finish with a wild boar ragu? Like, that was the biggest question for us. And not really having the answer, we just kind of did it and saw. And they did. They wanted dumplings to start their meal. And then they would have, like, a salad as a mid-course. And then they would finish with pasta. Like, it was like, okay, because that's how I would like to eat. That's how I ate, you know? And it worked. And I think people like my brother who were sort of against it, like, it's not going to work. There's no way this will succeed.
But, you know, working in, the other restaurants that you had before, did you see that, you know, palates were leaning towards a more global direction?
Absolutely. So,
yeah,
it wasn't like, it was definitely a eureka moment of working at these very established, well-received, you know, great restaurants
that saw no border. Right.
So take, for instance, my time at Blue Hill, Dan Barber and Michael Anthony were co-chefing at the time, and they bring, you know, with them each a very different set of, you know, skills. And Michael had worked in Japan for a while, and he really, I saw him use a lot of Japanese ingredients.
Right, like miso on some carrots or something.
That's right. And it worked really well and very harmoniously. So so I was like, okay, so this is a type of quote-unquote fusion that works when you do it right. And then also Anita at Anissa was definitely, it's like, her technique was French, and she worked at a lot of French restaurants, but she was bringing with her a lot of global, not just Chinese, you know, her background is Chinese American, but she would use some Korean ingredients, and we would talk about it. Like, I want to use naengmyeon for this next dish. And I'm like, what?
Do you remember how did she describe it, her restaurant then?
I think it was eclectic new American.
Oh yeah.
And that's when we came on the scene, we were also eclectic new American, but casual, right?
So yes,
whereas Blue Hill and Lisa, they were of the fine dining era.
Right.
I think they're my generation of people who were signing leases in Brooklyn were like, you know what? We're going to do great food, but in a casual setting and you know, not make it as sort of stuffy and unwelcoming.
Right.
And there are a lot of restaurants of that time that still exist today that sort of define, and I think there was a book written on it, right? So the Brooklyn New... Brooklyn New Cuisine.
That actually wasn't even that many. It's about maybe 2 years before, 3 or 4 years ago now.
Yeah.
And you're still around, though. A lot of these new Brooklyn
they're actually just starting to close now.
They're just starting to close. Or they've opened up... you know, what about Park Slope? What's her name? Italian.
Franny's?
Franny's is still there.
Still there, yeah.
The Bar Corvo.
Yeah, Bar Corvo.
And
Anna Klinger.
Anna Klinger, Aldi La.
Aldi La is still there.
Oh, yeah, she's going on like 18... Is she 20 years already, maybe?
I think that 2005 was when she opened.
That's right.
So a lot of these... we're here in Roberta's right now. That was another... game changer for the neighborhood, at least here. But so let's talk about your journey here, because you know, you've been around the block, and then, you know, in Red Hook you've weathered the storm of the century, hurricane or superstorm Sandy. And what happened then? You got flooded, you had to...
Yeah, it was a mess. It was a depressing, awful mess.
And you reopened.
And we decided to reopen. And I do, you know, Rachel and I talk about that in the book, about how that almost destroyed us.
Yeah.
But there was this resolve. You know, we're 8 years in.
Yeah.
And
you came back.
There was a moment, though, I did look at Ben. I was like, maybe this is... maybe we should just stop. There's some cosmic force telling us
to stop. Rather than stop, though, you opened a new restaurant in Gowanus. That took a while. Because you also built it. It's very large.
Yeah.
It's called Insa. Right. It also has karaoke booths.
Yeah.
And it's... it's a whole other beast.
It is. But I think everything... so the turning point for us as restaurateurs, creative people, chef, builder, was when Sandy happened and we rebuilt the restaurant even better. And that's actually when Sandy hit, I had the idea of writing this cookbook mm-hmm. and as well as doing something else.
Okay.
And the first with the book, it was like, okay, so we've been around for so long. We're going to be 10 years old soon. We should really sort of commemorate and just document that yeah. the Good Fork existed. Mm-hmm. And it really came from a place of sentimentality, like all these beautiful people that we met along the way. You
and
know,
they're lovingly employees. Depicted throughout this book yeah. and written about.
Yeah, and I just felt like, yes, yeah, a little restaurant in Brooklyn that could. And I felt like we had a really heartfelt story mm-hmm. to share. Mm-hmm. And the publisher and my editor got it right away.
Yeah.
And so I'm very proud of the book. With INSA, you know, that was us trying to be better business people uh-huh, and finding uh-huh. a location.
Totally
that
different
is a,
approach.
A, yeah, totally different
it.
Approach. Okay. Yeah. Big, but fun. Like, you know, I knew that we didn't want to do another Good Fork and call it the Silver Fork or the Excellent Fork. Like, that wasn't going to happen for us.
The Better Fork.
The Better Fork. The Good Fork the is very fork. Special in its own way, and yeah. it couldn't be followed up by anything. Mm-hmm. So the next project, I knew it would have to be something very different. And around that time, I felt like I was rediscovering, you know, the food that I grew up with.
Yeah.
I came here when I was 10. So there's
from
a lot
Korea.
Of memories, you okay. know, of Korea. And I think this happens to a lot of chefs, you know, who harbor a certain heritage or upbringing mm-hmm. in terms of
they
culture
come back
and
to
identity.
Their
yeah.
roots. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was what was happening for me several years ago, and I said to Ben, I was like, it should be Korean food, and I think uh-huh. it should be barbecue because it's so fun. And then he added, and karaoke. And I said, no.
No. You said no?
I said no initially because I didn't want it to sort of dilute, you know, the
gravitas.
Yes, of what I was trying to do with Korean food. Not that it should be serious, but I was like, well, are they going to take this less seriously because there's a karaoke component attached to it? And obviously the answer is no. Like, mm-hmm. why not have a great place to eat Korean food, celebrate with your friends, and party mm-hmm. in the karaoke room? Like, one stop.
They're
know,
really
fun
nice
time.
Karaoke rooms, too, I should add.
He did a great job. Yeah. And again, just like with the Good Fork, it was ground up building. And it was mm-hmm. really so fabulous to watch him be in his element and design and build a space.
From this raw space in the
totally
Gowanus.
Raw.
Yeah.
Totally raw.
Not too far.
I'm really envious of those skills. Have any of them rubbed off on you?
The carpentry?
No. Oh, not at all.
I just
all.
Think about all the
That's
things
okay
I could do if
own.
I knew how to do
yeah.
that.
All right, ladies, let's talk a lot more about some of these recipes after a quick little commercial interlude.
Okay.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. When you mill whole grains, you get all three parts, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. The bran, or the roughage, makes up about 14% of the whole grain. It's the outer skin of the edible kernel. It contains large amounts of B vitamins, some protein, trace minerals, phytochemicals, but most importantly, dietary fiber. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All right, you're listening to Eat Your Words, and I have a quick little plug message about a cool upcoming event. Are you a member of Heritage Radio Network yet? Because membership not only supports the production and the broadcast of this show, but it comes with some perks. So all current members are now invited to a monthly happy hour series called Books and Brews. Our first one will be April 12th. at Three's Brewing at Franklin and Kent in Greenpoint. And the host of Eat Your Words, myself, yours truly, and my new book, The Food of Taiwan, will be there. So you can get a signed copy of The Food of Taiwan, enjoy some beer, and meet some Heritage Radio Network hosts as well. So come on, join heritageradionetwork.org/donate to get your exclusive invite today. All right, so that should be fun. Hope you guys mm-hmm. can make it.
Yeah.
You're all welcome, of course. My guests are, again, Rachel Wharton and Sohee Kim. They have joined... teamed up to write the Good Fork Cookbook. And how did you guys... So he was just saying, you know, you decided to really commemorate this journey of opening the Good Fork. Did you want to write it yourself, or how did you get Rachel involved in the project?
Well, again, sort of the naive, like, I'm going to write a cookbook.
I'm going to open a restaurant.
Yeah, I'm going to write a cookbook. And, you know, my agent was like, okay, so you guys have this story to tell, so give it a try. But, you know, I strongly recommend working with a professional writer. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, but should we give it a try first? So we did. And she, in a very nice way, she's like, why don't you call Rachel Wharton? And I was like, I know that woman.
Yeah, so you guys already were very familiar with each other's work.
Do you remember the story? I called you?
No, I don't actually. I mean, because I don't. But I do remember as I wrote about her kimchi for Edible Brooklyn a bazillion years ago.
Yeah, and I still remembered. Oh, and that was such a nice story. And it was a great piece.
Were you pregnant?
I think I was pregnant.
That's amazing.
I was pregnant, yeah. With Oliver or something. Anyway, so, and I was like, oh, I know Rachel. She's awesome. And she's so great. And I had this great experience with her. And so I called you. And you're like, so he, I hope you're calling me because you want me to write.
Is that what I said?
Yeah, you did. Oh. I was like, yes, I am.
That is hilarious.
Great minds think alike.
Yeah. And so we reconnected, and she's a pro.
I want to say, so it took a while, I mean, to actually come up
recipes,
with the, to even come up with the format of the book for the proposal. Right. And it actually didn't gel until we were like a year into the process, like working on the recipes,
yeah,
getting them.
Yeah, how do you organize it? Should it be because meats and then sides and...
Which, I mean, even though those are fantastic ways to organize a cookbook, that's, for some reason I never want to do books organized like that.
Yeah. So breakfast, it was, lunch, I don't know.
They're like, oh, we have some big news. We're actually going to open the second restaurant. We were way into the process for this book, for the proposal at that point. And that's when we finally realized that it should be chronological. The chapters are like her growth, their growth as a restaurant and as a chef. Right. And so the last chapter is the beginnings of Insa.
Right. Ah. So called Sonmat, which means in Korean, taste of hand, which I use a lot of that term at Insa to sort of train new cooks and to get them to understand.
Okay. So, yeah, we have the kimchi recipe, the step-by-step photos, which I love, and then scallion pancakes, you know, with seafood, the pajun. Mm-hmm. And, it gets more Korean.
Yeah, it does. But definitely, there's four other chapters preceding that, obviously, and that really focuses
wild
on
wild boar ragu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one's good.
That one looks
There's
good.
A chapter called, you know, The Carpenter and the Cook, which...
Which is
the first menu
for the restaurant.
Right. So the opening one is parties, house parties, I think we call it.
When they were, you should talk about the cool job you had at the Sony Club. Was that it?
Yeah. Which gave you the opportunity to really
have a home life as a chef.
Right. So I worked for Anita. I worked for, you know, Dan, Michael, worked at Savoy. And so after I sort of did the restaurant stint, I was like, I need some stability in my life. I can't work too many crazy hours late at night and on the weekends. So I got a corporate job cooking at this place called Sony Club that used to be the Quilted Draft like 30 years ago.
Okay.
So they did fine dining food for the executives of Sony.
Right.
And they had it just it was a really well-funded corporate restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And so we were still doing very interesting things, but what the perk of it was that, you know, I got paid overtime, treated like an actual worker. And I had weekends, most weekends free. So then I was able to really hone in on the basic concept of my food.
Develop your style.
Right. And so that's the opening chapter, talking about these house parties that we had very up-and-coming neighborhood, Red Hook, as you mentioned, which was a different place back then. Wild dogs roaming, and there weren't a lot of, like, you know, people there yet.
Yeah.
So sort of the end of the world, you know, where is this in Brooklyn type of town? Mm-hmm. So we threw some epic parties in our backyard and married 8 couples in our backyard. Like, those are crazy fun times.
Wow.
So there was a lot to tell in the narrative of the
and
restaurant.
It's also really, it goes hand in hand with the type of food here. Because you could definitely, you know, looking at photos of the parties in the backyards, this food is like really fun, celebratory, colorful. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like a party, like each
and approachable.
And approachable.
It's not at all.
There's like a green bean salad with some citrus here and some nice like...
That's the long bean?
Yeah, long beans with the coconut lime vinaigrette.
Didn't I like fight for that to stay? I fought for that recipe to stay in the book.
Yeah, you did.
Tonkatsu, sweet breads, deep fried.
That one is also awesome.
That's just so much fun. And yeah, dumplings, pretty, you know, simple. So it's like, I just love the freewheeling style of the cooking. And I hope everyone can try this and throw a party too. Is that the...
That's the hope.
That's the, you know, that seems like the... type of cuisine.
Yeah, we didn't do menus.
Oh boy.
No, we didn't do menus.
We could do some and put them on your site.
We could.
It might be cool, actually.
Yeah.
We should do that.
So, I hear you guys are also working on a new cookbook.
Yeah.
Yes. In our spare time, we'll work up some menus and put them on the website. Yes.
So, yeah, it's going to be a cookbook, not about INSA this time, but, of course, it'll include a lot of the greatest hits of INSA restaurant.
Okay. It's
not about INSA. Mm-hmm. It is about Korean cooking.
Nice.
And I'm going to take a trip this summer to do a little research in Korea.
Awesome.
Atlanta, I haven't been there in 16 years, so it's going to be a great sort of, you know, homecoming kind of deal. So, yeah, a lot of exciting things in the works.
Very cool. I hope you invite me to the parties.
Of course. Of course.
Taste testing.
In 2 years.
Well, you know, the recipe testing, perhaps. It's been an absolute editing.
That's the best part.
The editing. Yeah, no, I'll help recipe test. Me recipes.
Will you come?
Yes.
And taste the recipes?
Yeah, definitely.
Because we're thinking about doing it. All the recipes in the Good Fork Cookbook was tested, you know, out of my house, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people helped. But
I know.
It was also shot. All the photography was shot in my living room. So it just was a fun process with beautiful photography by our friends, Booge and Zach, who live across the street.
So cool.
And it was a very comfortable, very painless, amazingly fun experience.
Yeah.
So for the second time around, you should come to my house and eat some Korean food.
I love it. I love the whole community vibe of it. And it worked out really well. So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for joining us, ladies.
Thank you.
I guess that's about all the time we have. But thanks, everyone at Heritage. And we'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.